A Matter of Spirit is the quarterly publication of the Intercommunity Peace and Justice Center, Spring 2015, issue on racism.
Anatomy of Racism in the U.S. by Guadalupe Guajardo, SNJM, Ph.D., and Kathleen Sadat. Guadalupe Guajardo, SNJM, Ph.D., is a senior consultant for the Nonprofit Association of Oregon and co-founder of Tools for Diversity. She also conducts equity and inclusion workshops. Kathleen Sadat, an African-American author and trainer, retired from the position of manager of diversity and inclusion for the City of Portland in 2012. She conducts diversity and inclusion workshops, does motivational speaking, and writes poetry. I hold two master's degrees and a Ph.D., but when traveling as a Latina, I often get mistaken as the hotel help. I will walk out of my room and be asked, "Can you please get me more towels?" Or I might be told, "My room is so clean, you do a really nice job." A white person would most likely not get asked or told this. They get the privilege of respect, while I am denied respect and stereotyped. In the United States, racism can be defined as the systematic mistreatment of people based on their membership in a group founded on skin color and/or racial and cultural characteristics, including language. This abuse is supported and enforced by society and all its institutions. What makes it difficult to discuss racism, much less dismantle, reduce, or eliminate it, is its complexity. Its anatomy is threefold. Racism has a purpose, content, and structure. Approaching its elimination on just one level will not be effective. Racism is a complex phenomenon, and therefore planning and carrying out its elimination will be complex and confusing. Even greater difficulty arises when the intersection of gender, class, abilities, and sexual orientation are added. Ultimately, we must address these complexities. Racism's elimination must be comprehensive and implemented at all levels. Perhaps a good place to start is naming that race is a social construct, a myth, if you will. Thousands of years ago, all different compositions of the world's people existed, but people didn't feel the need to organize into races. Who set out to determine that it was important to decide how many races we have? The subsequent myth of racism is that white people, another social construct, are superior in intelligence, character, and ability to people of color, and therefore entitled to manage, manipulate, rule, exploit, and control them. The purpose and function of racism is to privilege the lives of those in the dominant racial group at the expense of non-dominant racial members of U.S. culture. We can see this from European settlers running indigenous people of North America off their land and trading impractical objects such as beads for their valuable fur. This pattern of inequity has continued down the centuries. Racism continues to manifest itself in managing, exploiting, or excluding the skills, abilities, and labor of non-dominant groups in U.S. society for the benefit of the dominant group. These patterns of inequality get repackaged each century with variations affecting every group of color who has lived on the land we call the United States. The only changes are in the implementation. We can see current gradations of these attempts at social and economic control in all institutions, in employment disparities, in housing discrimination, in financial and real estate practices through redlining communities of color neighborhoods so they are not eligible for housing loans, in education through disparate dropout rates in high schools, in law enforcement through unjustified shooting and imprisonment of black and brown men, in food systems by placing lower quality food in low-income grocery stores and making stores inaccessible by putting them miles from communities of color, in protection by reducing fire stations in communities of color. It is easy to see these patterns and practices that make racism a system that is part of everyday life in America. The content or stereotypes of racism are based on the wide range of excuses used as rationale for the active abuse and discrimination of communities of color. One of the most frequent attacks is on our intelligence. A standard of thinking for the dominant Western world is linear thinking. Methods of thinking that do not adequately parallel that method are considered defective, deficient, and wrong. For example, I was called to consult on a workers' compensation case to explain the rules of conversation among immigrants. I told them in Latin America, adults often speak in an indirect contextual fashion, such as telling a story. This is expected when one is speaking to an intelligent adult who is able to follow along. They asked, "When is it okay to speak to someone directly?" "This is done only when speaking to children," I responded. "This is because they don't yet know how to surmise or connect dots and draw conclusions." Yet in the United States, indirect speaking is often considered inefficient and unprofessional. The myth of the superiority of white linear thinking provides the excuse for why people of color are excluded from full participation in society and denied many opportunities given to other U.S. citizens. The structures of racism are in the ways society and all its institutions, intentionally or unintentionally, have implemented policies, procedures, and practices that dehumanize, limit, or exclude people of color. These socioeconomic injustices are nested in employment hiring practices, resource distribution, how decisions are made, who sits at the table, and how and who gets promoted or elected into positions of authority. The alignment of these structures makes it very difficult to change systemic racism. Policies created to maintain the status quo must be revised or eliminated and replaced entirely. Allies to people of color who have learned how to leverage their privilege must be knowledgeable about the impact of policy and practices on institutions' racism. Policies, which outlive the human life cycle, becoming embedded in the culture of institutions, go unquestioned and unchallenged in our thinking and appear normal in the fabric of everyday life. Racism's close cousin is classism. When we intersect race with class, we get the same complex overlay of purpose, content, and structure. For capitalism to thrive, U.S. culture has to have an underclass of low-income and working-class people. Many, but not all, are people of color. Poor white people are encouraged to believe they are better off than people of color and cling to the theory of white supremacy by declaring, "At least I'm white." Bigotry and biases discourage poor white people and people of color from seeing themselves as allies on the same side of the economic equation. Derrick Bell, the first tenured African-American professor of law at Harvard Law School, argues that racism is a distraction from our own economic exploitation, and those at the highest level benefit from the ways we are pitted against each other. We must ask ourselves, in the mix of money and politics, who profits from racism? Bias and bigotry, translated into systemic policy and law, ensure that people of color will continue to be disadvantaged and underrepresented in all of the institutions and systems that make up our society. The exploitation of people of color helps members of the dominant culture in their quest to live healthy, materialistic lives denied to many people of color. Those that promote the elimination of racism have come to recognize the need for systems thinking. Systemic thinking proposes we can start to change a system from any point in an institution, from the janitor to the CEO. Systems thinking gives us room to explore the incredibly complex intersection of social constructs that support discrimination and bigotry. Without systems thinking, we will again and again fall into a trap of thinking either or, which will cause us to fall short in designing new systems which are inclusive and foundational for actualizing Dr. King's vision of beloved community. Steve Biko, an anti-apartheid activist in South Africa, said, "The greatest weapon in the hands of the oppressor is the mind of the oppressed." Relentless racism and ongoing discrimination haunt many people of color with feelings of not being good enough or smart enough to affect change. I feel this all the time. If I'm the only woman of color in a room full of white people, as soon as I open my mouth, I know everyone will be listening to see whether I am articulate. To address some of these insecurities and build new leaders, organizations such as the Latino Leaders Program, the Global Majority Project, and the American Leadership Forum in Oregon are implementing leadership development and training programs. There appears to be increased interest in the real racial history of the United States. Several films in the last few years reflect a more in-depth exploration of the lives and experiences of some people of color in this country, such as Cesar Chavez and 12 Years a Slave. Gaps still remain in the portrayal of American Indians and of Asian people who helped build this country. These films and the presence of America's first African-American president support what appears to be a greater willingness by white people to discuss race among themselves and with people of color. Many people are asking, "What can I do to make a difference?" People in the United States and around the globe are actively calling for an end to bigotry and discrimination. People in Beijing, France, and Africa, far from recent events in Ferguson, Missouri, were seen chanting, "Hands up, don't shoot," in support of those protesting the shooting of unarmed black youth like Michael Brown. Everyone has a role to play in dismantling America's racial systems. We can make a difference by stepping into roles of leadership on both profit and non-for-profit boards of directors, serving on governmental committees, working with community-based organizations, and assuming positions with authority, responsibility, and influence. White allies who understand the dynamics of privilege and the matrix of oppression are a necessary part of dismantling racism. Those who are aware and have accepted the reality of white privilege can use their privilege to bring equity and inclusion to the workplace. To be an effective ally, white people must examine their discomfort about race and explore their fear of being ostracized by other white people or losing promotions or even jobs. Ultimately, the most meaningful work will come from the collaboration of people of color and white allies who understand how the oppression of people of color affects their lives, the lives of their children, and the life of our country. Racism hurts everyone. When we make coffee, the water becomes coffee one drip at a time. Change needs to happen, and the slow drip method is probably the most realistic way. If everyone does one thing every day to interrupt racism, it will be eliminated. But we need to do it now. "Hope dies last," is a common saying in Spanish. Hope is an essential ingredient in our efforts to eliminate the impact of racism and fear on our lives. We must provide hope for one another. Hope is the catalyst for change. I try to live in the understanding that we all have suffering, we all have pain, we are all moving through the world with our own wounds, and we are all asked to heal each other. I have good days and bad days, but on good days I can remember there's only one way that is true. the human way, and that gives me hope.
Dismantling Racism by Patricia Chappelle and Anne-Louise Nadeau, Sisters of Notre Dame de Namur. The Oxford Dictionary defines power as energy, the potential or right to control people or things. Privilege is defined as a special advantage granted only to a certain person or group beyond the advantage of most. With regards to racism, power as a noun is lethal when wedded to laws, systems, organizations, policies, practices, and procedures which legitimize the control of groups of people. This kind of power is toxic when misused to bestow and claim rights and the privilege of immunity to whole groups of people based merely on skin color. It is how we use both power and privilege which builds up or destroys the whole human community. Those of us who benefit from and perpetuate the misuse of power and privilege are members of the white community, a reality and issue that we must struggle to come to grips with, since racism is our issue as a collective and not an issue only for communities of color. Privilege and power are the conscious and unconscious inheritance that we live and breathe on a daily basis. Because some of it is unconscious, many of us are not aware of its effects. Yet, when we do recognize it, or it is pointed out to us, we become defensive out of fear that we might be responsible, which we are. We do not want to recognize that responsibility, since it would require us to change, leading to transformation and accountability to communities of color. So, we go along sabotaging ourselves from engaging in honest and healthy relationships with other white people, as well as with people of color. In order to understand how racism works, we need to want to become aware of our white privilege, and to ask for the grace to do so will lead to doing some serious homework. We have discovered the work required is not a once-and-for-all exercise, nor is it a fleeting theme that once we've figured it out, life goes on. Rather, we carry the responsibility of engaging and building up the whole community to realize who has been excluded from laws enacted in our country and who is not included in our organizational, congregational mission statements, our hiring and education policies, our formation policies and practices. This is the conscious and intentional work of a lifetime. Those of us from communities of color also have homework, but it is a different kind. From personal experience, and from being the recipients of unjust laws and practices, we know firsthand the crushing reality of white power and privilege. Thus, we approach life from a different perspective. We have been socialized to understand and recognize white privilege in order to survive within the dominant culture. Some of us have adapted so we can fit in, get along, be accepted, and benefit from some of the crumbs that have fallen from the table of those in power. others of us have pushed against white power and privilege for our whole life, trying to confront our internalized racial oppression and reclaim our heritage and dignity. This is the conscious and intentional work of a lifetime. Once we honestly want to work to dismantle racism, we face some formidable barriers. We still live under the cloud of mistrust and suspicion from institutions committed to the well-being and safety of all. Our U.S. educational system does not provide equal access to resources. The ongoing pushback against the Voting Rights Act is making it harder and harder for us to exercise our right to vote. The Stand Your Ground principle allows the use of deadly force in perceived self-defense without attempting to retreat. Our prison system criminalizes a disproportionate number of people of color. The selective redistricting in some white communities makes it impossible for us to live where we want. There is a recent lack of accountability to communities of color in the killing of our youth by white officers, and the list could go on. These are major barriers that communities of color face when we lay claim to what is rightfully ours and begin to address our internalized racial oppression together as communities of color. As members of the white collective, our common barriers to dismantling racism, if taken seriously, will require transformation, which is difficult, uncomfortable, and for some, way too much work. Initially, we do not see any benefit in putting in the time and effort to confront our unearned power and privilege. We let ourselves off the hook by believing we are not the ones who play the race card, when in fact we do all the time. If, however, we do begin on this journey, there is a price to pay for those of us who are white. Some will perceive us as having betrayed our tribe, and we stand to lose friends who do not understand why we are so committed to dismantling racism and privilege. If we continue on this course, we risk being transformed, and with transformation, there is no turning back. It will require of us decisions regarding where we live, where we put our energy, how we pray and read scripture, as well as how we interpret the front page of local newspapers. We will begin making connections between immigration, torture, poverty, trafficking, and seeing that the common thread through all of these social issues is racism. In confronting our internalized racial superiority together as a collective, we can begin to see life as it really is. When each of our collectives intentionally works on our internalized racial oppression and superiority, then we can begin the work of dismantling racism together. We bring to this journey our different perspectives and life experiences, as well as our values and core beliefs regarding oppression and superiority. We develop a style of decision-making that offers a voice and a wholeness to everyone and avoids categories of either or. We begin to reverence both and decisions, and slowly begin to build the trust that leads to right relationships among us. This is the work we must do together. No one group can dismantle racism alone. We have been heartened and hope-filled by two recent experiences in our work at Pax Christi USA, PC USA. This year, PC USA gathered Catholic communities of color in six major U.S. cities to review Catholic social teaching and dialogue with local Pax Christi members on ways to be in solidarity with communities of color in addressing issues in their neighborhoods. At each site, we brought together a group of 30 to 40 individuals from the Latino, Latina, African American, and white communities. We intentionally invited Catholic facilitators who were African American and Hispanic to present the corrective history of these communities within the Catholic Church. Through shared dialogue and mutual respect, those gathered have begun to take collective action to address the issues identified by the communities of color. The other very encouraging sign has been in the privilege of working with young adults from a local university who engage in service as part of their curriculum. When students are exposed to working within diverse communities and are open to processing their experiences, they begin to question the why of the injustices they see. They are open to looking honestly at racial oppression and white privilege and confronting it within themselves and others. Thereby, they are becoming equipped to engage in critical social analysis, which moves them to action. These experiences give us hope and the strength to continue the work entrusted to us by a God who is good, gracious, and desiring of justice for all peoples.
Judge Deborah Thomas sentences young offenders to more education, by Christine Dubois. Christine Dubois is a widely published freelance writer and writing instructor who lives with her family near Seattle. Visit her at www.christinedubois.com. When Deborah Thomas sees young people in trouble with the law, she doesn't hesitate to tell them to finish their high school education. In fact, she orders them to do so. Thomas, a judge on the Wayne County Circuit Court in Detroit, believes in the power of education to open doors to better opportunities. A former high school teacher, lawyer, and one of the first African American women elected to the county court, she credits education, along with a can-do attitude, for her success. Thomas sentences young offenders to complete their diploma or GED as part of their probation. They also must do community service, undergo drug testing, and check in with their probation officer. "I've been accused of running my courtroom like a classroom," Thomas says. "That's basically what it is." She has a resource file on her bench detailing GED programs at 31 locations throughout Detroit, as well as information on substance abuse treatment, literacy programs, and other resources. And like any proud teacher, the wall in her courtroom is adorned with certificates of those who have completed their assignment. The wall gives recognition and tells other people, "They did it, you can too," she explains. "They'll be looking over my shoulder saying, 'I'm going to get mine up there too.'" Most of the offenders who appear in Judge Thomas's courtroom are minorities aged 17 to 25 who have been arrested for auto theft, domestic violence, or probation violations. Poverty and lack of education go hand in hand, she says. They come from families where they are the first to get a high school diploma. The encouragement may not have been there. Thomas also educates the broader community through bi-monthly public forums on legal topics. On February 5th, she took part in a panel with police and prosecutors in Battle Creek, Michigan, attended by 200 high school students and parents. She urged the young people to anticipate the results of their actions the same way they plan their moves in a computer game. When interacting with police, say yes, sir, or yes, ma'am, and keep your hands in view. Back in Detroit, she said, when you're sitting in church, you raise your hands to the Lord. When you come into contact with the police, I can't think of a better time for you to be calling on the Lord. Thomas has overcome her own share of obstacles. Her father, a postal employee, died of cancer when she was 10. Her mother went back to school and became a licensed nurse. She encouraged her daughter that more education meant a better job. I had the benefit of growing up under Dr. King and the Kennedy administration when it was said, you can do it, and you refuse to take no for an answer. Thomas received a bachelor's in sociology from Western Michigan University, a master's in criminal justice from the University of Detroit, and a law degree from Valparaiso University. She worked for UAW Legal Services, the Michigan State Department of Labor, and the Southeast Michigan Transportation Authority before going into private practice in 1984. Believing they could get more community representation on the county court, Thomas tried to talk her colleagues into running, but no one thought a black judge could be elected countywide. Finally, she recalls, an attorney said, if you're so certain, why don't you do it? I put my hand on my hip and I said, fine, I will. That was 1994. She's been on the bench ever since. What keeps her coming back? I truly believe I am helping people. I help both on the victim side and the offender side. Sometimes the victims need an opportunity to say, this is what happened to me. And for offenders that are in need of services, substance abuse, education, literacy, I'm able to provide information. As a whole, it makes for a healthier community.
Black Lives Matter. Eliminating Racial Inequity in the Criminal Justice System. By Nazgul Ghannouch, Ph.D. Every time you see me, you want to mess with me, Eric Garner told a group of approaching New York City police officers. As they wrestled him to the ground to arrest him for selling untaxed loose cigarettes, an officer placed Garner in a chokehold and maintained his grip, despite Garner's pleas for air. 1 hour later, Garner was pronounced dead. The unarmed black man's death and the white officer's non-indictment, despite video evidence, have heightened concerns about police practices and accountability. In the wake of the fatal police shooting of unarmed teenager Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, and that officer's non-indictment, a growing number of Americans are outraged and demanding change. Black Lives Matter has become a rallying cry in light of evidence that the criminal justice system is failing to uphold this basic truth. Official data, although woefully inadequate, show that over half of those killed by police in recent years have been black or Latino. Officers involved in these killings are rarely indicted, much less convicted, for excessive use of force, and official responses to recent protests have spurred further controversy, militarized police forces, disrupted public assemblies in Ferguson, and New York City's police union blamed pro-reform politicians and nonviolent protesters for the killing of two officers by a mentally unstable man. The criminal justice system's high volume of contact with people of color is a major cause of African Americans' disproportionate rate of fatal police encounters, as well as of broader perceptions of injustice in many communities. This article identifies four key features of the justice system that contribute to its disparate racial impact and presents recent best practices for targeting these inequities drawn from adult and juvenile justice systems around the country. Policing is by no means the only stage of the justice system that produces racial disparity. Disadvantage accumulating at each step of the process contributes to blacks and Latinos comprising 56% of the incarcerated population, yet only 30% of the U.S. population. The roots of this disparity precede criminal justice contact. Conditions of socioeconomic inequality contribute to higher rates of certain violent and property crimes among people of color. But four features of the justice system exacerbate this underlying inequality. Number one, many ostensibly race-neutral policies and laws have a disparate racial impact. Police policies such as broken windows or aggressive policing of low-level offenses to prevent future violent crimes and stop and question and frisk have disproportionately impacted young men of color. In New York City, blacks and Hispanics made up half of the population over age 16 between 2001 and 2013, yet they represented four-fifths of those who were stopped and frisked, received summonses, and were arrested for misdemeanor crimes. In addition, prosecutorial policies such as plea bargain guidelines that tie plea offers to arrest histories disadvantage blacks and Latinos, as do sentencing laws that dictate harsher punishment for crimes for which people of color are disproportionately arrested. Number two, criminal justice practitioners' use of discretion is, often unintentionally, influenced by racial bias. Racial disparities in traffic stops have diminished on a nationwide basis in recent years, but persist in many jurisdictions. Police officers are more likely to stop black and Hispanic drivers for investigative reasons. Once pulled over, people of color are three times as likely as whites to be searched, and blacks are twice as likely as whites to be arrested. In jurisdictions like Ferguson, blacks are 3.5 times as likely as whites to be stopped and 1.7 times more likely to be searched, even though police have a higher contraband hit rate when searching white versus black drivers. Prosecutors and judges also often treat blacks and Hispanics more harshly in their charging and sentencing decisions. Number three, key segments of the criminal justice system are underfunded, putting blacks and Latinos, who are disproportionately low income, at a disadvantage. Most states inadequately fund their indigent defense programs, which provide legal services and representation to those who cannot afford it. Pretrial release often requires a money bond, which can be prohibitive to low-income individuals and increases the pressure on them to accept less favorable plea deals. Many parole and probation systems offer supervision with little support. Public drug treatment programs are also underfunded, thereby limiting treatment and sentencing alternatives for low-income individuals. Number four, criminal justice policies exacerbate socioeconomic inequalities by imposing collateral consequences on those with criminal records and by diverting public spending. Criminal conviction creates a barrier to securing steady employment, and those with felony drug convictions are disqualified from public assistance and public housing in many areas. In addition, allocating public resources to punitive programs comes at the expense of investments in crime prevention and drug treatment programs. Because of their higher rates of incarceration and poverty, people of color are disproportionately affected by these policy choices. Following are some of the programs and policies drawn from adult and juvenile justice systems across the country designed to address the criminal justice system's high rate of contact with people of color. In many cases, these practices have produced demonstrable results. Number one, revise policies and laws with disparate racial impact. New York City curbed its stop and frisk policy after successful litigation and the election of a mayor with a reform agenda. Mayor Bill de Blasio vowed that his administration would not break the law to enforce the law, and significantly curbed a policy that was described by a federal judge as one of indirect racial profiling. Thus far, the reform has not adversely impacted crime rates. The mayor and police commissioner William Bratton remain committed, though, to broken windows policing. Indiana amended its drug-free school zone sentencing laws, which had imposed harsh penalties on a defendant population that was over 75% African American in Indianapolis. The reform's components included reducing drug-free zones from 1,000 feet to 500 feet to account for urban density and requiring that minors be reasonably expected to be present when the drug offense occurs. Connecticut, Delaware, Kentucky, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and South Carolina have also amended their laws. Several school districts have challenged the school-to-prison pipeline, which disproportionately affects students of color, by enacting new school disciplinary policies to reduce racial disparities in out-of-school suspensions and police referrals. Reforms at Florida's Miami-Dade and Broward County public schools have cut school-based arrests by more than half in 5 years and significantly reduced suspensions. The Los Angeles Unified School District has enacted new disciplinary policies to reduce reliance on its school police department. Number two, address implicit racial bias among criminal justice professionals. In Milwaukee, prosecutors previously filed drug paraphernalia charges against 73% of black suspects, but only 59% of white suspects. Working with the Vera Institute of Justice, the office was able to eliminate these disparities by reviewing data on outcomes, stressing diversion to treatment or dismissal, and requiring attorneys to consult with supervisors prior to filing such charges. U.S. District Court Judge Mark W. Bennett spends 25 minutes discussing implicit bias with the potential jurors in his court. His jurors watch video clips demonstrating bias in hidden camera situations, receive instructions on avoiding bias, and sign a pledge. Although the impact of this approach has not been measured, mock jury studies have shown that increasing the salience of race reduces biased decision-making. Number three, create a fair playing field by reallocating resources. In 2014, New Jersey reformed its bail system to emphasize risk assessment over monetary bail, a reform that is expected to increase rates of pretrial release. Previously, the decision to detain defendants was based on their ability to post bail, regardless of their risk level. Judges may now release lower-risk individuals who cannot afford bail and may deny pretrial release for high-risk individuals. Berks County, Pennsylvania, reduced the number of youth in secure detention, who were primarily youth of color, by 67% between 2007 and 2012, in part by increasing reliance on alternatives including non-secure shelters and expanding use of evidence-based treatment programs. Because many of these youth had committed technical violations of their probation terms, this broader range of alternatives made it possible to keep them out of detention without harming public safety. Number 4. Revise policies that exacerbate socioeconomic inequalities, redirect public spending toward crime prevention and drug treatment. In 2014, California voters approved Proposition 47, which reclassifies a number of low-level offenses from felonies to misdemeanors. This allows 10,000 incarcerated individuals to petition to have their sentences reduced. Moreover, a significant portion of projected state prison savings, estimated to be $150 to $250 million annually, will be allocated to mental health and substance abuse treatment, programs to reduce school truancy and prevent dropouts, and support for victim services. To reduce barriers to employment, many jurisdictions now ban the box or remove the question about conviction history from initial job applications and delay a background check until later in the hiring process. 12 states, including Maryland, Illinois, and California, and 60 cities, including Atlanta and New York City, have passed these reforms. Advocates have urged states to end the denial of federal cash assistance and food stamp benefits for people convicted of felony drug offenses. These bans primarily affect low-income women of color. The 1996 Personal Responsibility and Work Opportunity Reconciliation Act that created the ban also permitted states to opt out or modify its terms. To date, 13 states have fully opted out of the cash assistance ban and 9 from the food stamp ban. Others have opted out in part through smaller changes, such as making access dependent on type of drug offense or enrollment in treatment. Despite substantial progress in achieving racial justice in American society over the past half century, racial disparities in the criminal justice system have persisted and worsened in many respects. Among African American men born just after World War II, 15% of those without a high school degree were imprisoned by their mid-30s. For those born in the 1970s, 68% were imprisoned by their mid-30s. The country has made progress on these issues in recent years. New York and other large states have significantly reduced their prison populations, and the juvenile justice system has reduced youth confinement and detention by over 40% since 2001. The racial gap in incarceration rates has begun to narrow. The Garner case has also sensitized many white Americans to problems in the justice system, with 47% of whites nationwide and half in New York City stating that the officer should have been indicted. But demonstrators have echoed Garner's final words, "I can't breathe," and the message attributed to Brown, "Hands up, don't shoot," in public protests, because there is much left to do. As proven by the jurisdictions highlighted in this article, reforms can improve criminal justice outcomes by targeting the four key causes of racial disparity. We must now expand the scale and increase the speed of these efforts. Nazgul Gandush, PhD, is a research analyst at the Sentencing Project, a national nonprofit organization engaged in research and advocacy on criminal justice issues. She conducts and synthesizes research on racial disparities in incarceration, public opinion about punishment, and sentencing policies.
The Church and Racism: A Voice Crying in the Wilderness, by Clarence Williams. As we approach the 50th anniversary of the assassination of Reverend Dr. Martin Luther King, Jr., the Church still has not found its voice to address racism as a whole. There are 100 million Catholics of African descent in this hemisphere. The overwhelming majority find themselves in Catholic countries under deplorable conditions. Yet there is little mention of them in the Church in the United States. We know more about the people of Africa than of the black Catholics across town. Today, I see the depth that 500 years of the crushing weight of racial dysfunction in the Western Hemisphere has made on non-whites and whites alike. But lessons from our Catholic history are the same as society in general. Leadership is the answer. The battle is in the circle of elites, whether in the church or society. In every age, there are signs of hope when leadership finds its sober voice to deliver the church from racism, to deliver us from thinking, feeling, praying under the influence of racial dysfunction. The racial dysfunction paradigm for the U.S. Church was founded on the church elite's response to Rome's insistence on evangelizing the newly freed blacks following the Civil War. The U.S. bishops resisted the change of focus and resources, opting to remain committed to the progress of European immigrants. The response was to have a national collection each year, even unto this day, for the Negro and African American Indian Mission Fund. This money was given to missionaries from religious orders to fulfill the request from Rome. This decision made black people a mission project of the American white church, not a part of it. In its deference to European ethnocentrism, this effort reinforced white supremacy culture in the Catholic Church. The Church, knowingly or unknowingly, adopted the cultural model of separate and unequal. It also entrusted the black community to missionary orders of whites, who became social lepers among other clergy and religious. These heroic and holy missionaries were considered race traitors for evangelizing, befriending, and educating those people. At the time of European immigration from Catholic countries, the various incoming groups were not considered white people. They were listed as ethnic groups, just as the Spanish-speaking Catholics are today. It took until the 1950s for all the Catholic ethnic groups, Germans, Irish, Italians, etc., to become white. St. Paul's letter to the Galatians frames the issues of race, gender, and class at the birth of the Christian experience. He observed the racially dysfunctional behavior of St. Peter. In Antioch, Peter lived and ate with the Gentile converts. However, upon the arrival of other Jews from Jerusalem, he avoided the Gentiles. Paul's letter is a witness to his intervention on Peter's behavior of supporting the supremacy of Jewish culture over constructing a new Christian culture of inclusion and enfranchisement through baptism. The core Christian message on racism is that there is no place for it. There is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free person. There is not male and female, for you are all one in Christ Jesus. Galatians 3:28. Racism is a sin against God, the creator of the human family, and against God's children, our brothers and sisters. In my ministry of racial sobriety, we invite people to create a racial history journal. The purpose is to demonstrate that each of us has been formed and nurtured in a racialized culture and is shaped by countless experiences. The goal is to show that we are not responsible for the racism all around us, but we are responsible for our response to the present racism that impacts us. Racial sobriety is witnessing to ourselves and others that our thinking, feeling, and acting reflect our commitment to seeing each person as a member of the same human family. We need self-awareness to free ourselves of racial dysfunction, the improper relationship with members of the same human family, in order to become a fully functioning human being. The ministry of racial sobriety begins with the commitment to become the change you want to see. It transforms the culture around us. In our interpersonal relationships, S-O-B-E-R means seeing others as being entitled to respect. From a social perspective, S-O-B-E-R means seeing others as being equally regarded. From a global perspective, S-O-B-E-R means seeing others as being extended relations in the human family. Our voice of racial sobriety is needed to talk ourselves sober. There is little support in our society, schools, or churches to find or develop this voice. Leaders who seek to find their voice will need courage in a culture in which RACE is treated like a four-letter word. Overcoming any fear takes courage, which can emerge when we identify the origin of our anxiety. The journey toward racial sobriety is challenged by forces within and outside of ourselves, and toward a culture of racial sobriety. What can the church do to find its voice today? In sharing this healing ministry, I have witnessed leadership seeking to establish cultures of racial sobriety in more than 70 dioceses and archdioceses. It is a ministry of supporting the efforts of leaders who engage their diocese, educational settings, religious communities, and national Catholic organizations in transformative change. One province chose to publish a wall calendar to unite members in the healing process from the daily racial dysfunction in our lives. A major denomination now requires a certification in racial sobriety for ordination to ministry. The leadership sees this as necessary, as St. Paul would in his day. These religious leaders are agents of the church, promoting the voice of the church. Racial sobriety opens our capacity for personal and spiritual development of our personal voice and our corporate witness. Other leaders in the church are also finding their voice. An example is Archbishop Robert Carlson of St. Louis, who gathered people to witness to the power of solidarity in the face of the shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri, that captured the world's attention. Organizations within the Catholic Church are also acting, such as the National Black Catholic Clergy Caucus, which issues statements about the racial crisis of today, inviting men and women of goodwill to join us in prayer and action for peace, justice, and reconciliation in our nation. The National Office of St. Vincent de Paul published the most comprehensive guidelines and multicultural training available in the Catholic Church today, naming the importance of diversity within their own organization. The Society of St. Vincent de Paul is great because it's made up of people of many cultures, many races, many walks of life, many points of view. Our diversity, like that of the nations, reflects our strength. There are voices of racial sobriety today in the church, but so many more are needed. If we only had the vigilance, commitment of leadership, and devotion of resources to protect all of God's children, what a voice we would be in answering the prayer of Jesus, that all be one. One hurdle is the don't talk rule. This rule describes, quote, the elephant in the living room, unquote, where a family or group colludes to deny its existence. Racism is the elephant in the American living room, and by extension, in the White House living room. The don't talk rule discourages any conversation on this topic. We need the voices of those who have moved beyond denial, the voices who have taken to the streets, to be heard over the deafening silence of social collusion within our white supremacy culture of today. A second hurdle is racial anxiety within ourselves. Three elements of racial anxiety are fear, ignorance, and guilt, the fig complex. The fear is of not knowing what might happen if we break the silence. The ignorance is of not knowing how to respectfully refer to someone's race, nationality, ethnic group. How do we begin the conversation? The guilt is in feeling that we should be better at dealing with the subject and responding to situations. Unfortunately, the more guilt we feel, the more fearful we become, and our racial anxiety forms an emotional cage which imprisons us. But when we identify any element of our racial anxiety, it loses its power over us. We break a leg of the stool and topple our cage. We are set free in that moment. Racial sobriety, as a spiritual exercise, continually calls the fig devil by name and provides grace-filled moments of deliverance from living under the influence of our racial dysfunction. The Ministry of Racial Sobriety. The Ministry of Racial Sobriety begins in discipleship and ends in apostleship. The discipleship requires a formational journey to the heart of Jesus. Jesus' prayer for unity in the Holy Family, in the human family, as seen in the Holy Trinity, so that they may be one just as we are one. From John 17:11-21, is the heart of this ministry. The apostolic ministry is one of transformation. It is a process by which we transfer our racial sobriety formation to those around us. Let us enjoy the graces of racial sobriety and share them with our brothers and sisters.
We will be heard. We have a voice. We have a story. Undocumented high school students in Oakland, California, were growing tired of the media's portrayal of young immigrants. The only two narratives told were of violent youth in gangs and, to strike contrast, of those who rose above all circumstances to be valedictorians. Most undocumented youth do not fit into either story, and instead, as one said, we're invisible, in the shadows, and unheard. A study by the Migration Policy Institute estimated that 67% of the 2.1 million eligible undocumented youth will be unable to gain legal status from the DREAM Act because of application fees and education attainment requirements. This information motivated the students to create 67 dreams to tell the stories of the youth who make up this 67%. Many have been personally affected by deportations of family members and have never talked about their experiences, afraid of being deported themselves. The group organizes encounters where undocumented youth meet and share their stories. Without revealing identities, they publish videos to illumine the voices hidden in the shadows and collect information on their common experiences. They want others to know that they are not alone in this country, while carrying out their mission of raising underprivileged migrant youth voices to expand the debate and legislative possibilities. Their powerful stories are spreading their message. We're just like you, and we will be heard.
10 things everyone should know about race. 1. Race is a modern idea. Ancient societies, like the Greeks, did not divide people according to physical distinctions, but according to religion, status, class, even language. The English language didn't even have the word race until it turns up in 1508 in a poem by William Dunbar referring to a line of kings. 2. Race has no genetic basis. Not one characteristic, trait, or even gene distinguishes all the members of one so-called race from all the members of another so-called race. 3. Human subspecies don't exist. Unlike many animals, modern humans simply haven't been around long enough, or isolated enough, to evolve into separate subspecies or races. Despite surface appearances, we are one of the most similar of all species. 4. Skin color really is only skin deep. Most traits are inherited independently from one another. The genes influencing skin color have nothing to do with the genes influencing hair form, eye shape, blood type, musical talent, athletic ability, or forms of intelligence. Knowing someone's skin color doesn't necessarily tell you anything about him or her. 5. Most variation is within, not between, races. Of the small amount of total human variation, 85% exists within any local population, be they Italians, Kurds, Koreans, or Cherokees. About 94% can be found within any continent. That means two random Koreans may be just as genetically different as a Korean and an Italian. 6. Slavery predates race. Throughout much of human history, societies have enslaved others, often as a result of conquest or war, even debt, but not because of physical characteristics or a belief in natural inferiority. Due to a unique set of historical circumstances, ours was the first slave system where all of the slaves shared similar physical characteristics. 7. Race and freedom evolved together. The U.S. was founded on the radical new principle that all men are created equal, but our early economy was based largely on slavery. How could this anomaly be rationalized? The new idea of race helped explain why some people could be denied the right and freedoms that others took for granted. 8. Race justified social inequalities as natural. As the race idea evolved, white superiority became common sense in America. It justified not only slavery, but also the extermination of Indians, exclusion of Asian immigrants, and the taking of Mexican lands by a nation that professed a belief in democracy. Racial practices were institutionalized within American government, laws, and society. 9. Race isn't biological, but racism is still real. Race is a powerful social idea that gives people different access to opportunities and resources. Our government and social institutions have created advantages that disproportionately channel wealth, power, and resources to white people. This affects everyone, whether we are aware of it or not. 10. Colorblindness will not end racism. Pretending race doesn't exist is not the same as creating equality. Race is more than stereotypes and individual prejudice. To combat racism, we need to identify and remedy social policies and institutional practices that advantage some groups at the expense of others. A Matter of Spirit is a publication of the Intercommunity Peace and Justice Center. Sponsoring communities include the Adrian Dominican Sisters, Congregation of the Sisters of St. Joseph of Peace, Oregon Province Jesuits, Sisters of the Holy Names of Jesus and Mary, U.S. Ontario Province, Sisters of Providence, Mother Joseph Province, Sisters of St. Francis of Philadelphia, and the Tacoma Dominicans. Affiliate communities include Benedictine Sisters of Cottonwood, Idaho, Benedictine Sisters of Lacey, Benedictine Sisters of Mount Angel, Dominican Sisters of San Rafael, Religious of the Sacred Heart, Cincinnati Dominicans, Sisters of Charity of the Blessed Virgin Mary, Sisters of St. Joseph of Carondelet, Sisters of St. Mary of Oregon, Society of the Holy Child Jesus, Society of the Sacred Heart, and the Ursuline Sisters of the Roman Union. Our editorial board for this issue was Timnit Germe, Gretchen Gundrum, Linda Haydock, Vince Herberholt, Tom Hulsher, and Nick Mealy. Our editor is Anna Patrice Clark, and the layout of the print edition was done by Justin Almeida. For more information, please visit our website at www.ipjc.org.